Hi, I'm John Taylor Gatto. I spent most of my life as John Gatto, but one day a principal named John Gatto called me from Long Island and said that his life was being destroyed, and could I find some way, please, he begged me, to discriminate this John Gatto from that John Gatto, or otherwise he said his goose was cooked. So I became John Gatto, John Taylor Gatto at that moment. I was a New York City public school teacher of junior high school kids for 30 years on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which includes Harlem and Spanish Harlem, and I taught in both the white aristocratic ghetto of the Upper West Side of Manhattan and the Spanish ghetto of Manhattan and the black ghetto of Manhattan for 30 years, and during that time I began to draw some conclusions about the institution of schooling, about the nature of kids and their learning. And when I left teaching in 1991 on an editorial on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal called I Quit, I Think, I was going to become a garlic farmer in upstate New York, and I do indeed own a farm there near Ithaca, New York. But I got a phone call from the Librarians Association in Colorado, of all places, and then I got another call a few days later, all based on the Wall Street Journal editorial, from the Engineers Colloquium at NASA Goddard Space Center, and then I got a call from the Vice President. And with those three appearances, I was off and running, although I never advertised. As the calls came in, I responded. And when I go to Australia next week or week after next to do the keynote for the Australia Education Convention, it will mark the 2 millionth mile I've traveled in the last 12 years. I had a tremendous anger, and the anger fueled me in trying to disseminate a message that schooling itself is a highly questionable practice, and that includes the good schools as well as the bad schools. It's possible to derive some value from it, but the danger and the damage is always, I think, much greater than the value that's possible. And in many, many instances, there's no value offered. It's simply a confinement exercise. When I started out, I probably, if I were to be classified, would have fit the definition of a school reformer. But the longer I researched, traveled, spoke, and reevaluated my 30 classroom years, which were, by the school's lights, quite successful. I was the New York State Teacher of the Year, and I was the New York City Teacher of the Year 3 consecutive years. So by the system's evaluation, I was doing great. But as I look back over my encounters with kids and parents and administrators and with myself, you know, I came to see a set of much darker themes than were evident to me in action. So I began to write books, and I've written 4 to this moment, and I'm working on a 5th, which I pray will be the last book. I never want to hear the word school for the rest of my life or see a school building. But I have taken a much darker tack, or it imposed itself on me. The more I understood the historical currents that were at work in creating this institution, the more I saw that it doesn't lead to the kind of world that I personally want to live in, that it definitely has a distinct purpose, and that purpose has been successfully achieved. And because of our schooling and the schooling in Britain and in Germany, our form of schooling has spread worldwide. So we now have a, a well-schooled planet. As I gaze out after 70 years of life, I'm not at all pleased with the planet, let alone with schooling.
What is the purpose of public education?
I would say that throughout Western history, and I won't pretend to know anything significant about Eastern history, but throughout Western history, schools existed. They were very short-term, and they were never considered very important. They would occupy 6 weeks or 2 months out of a year, and their stated purpose was to discover the will of God so that good lives could be led by harmonizing oneself with that will. So call that the first purpose of schooling. Call it the religious purpose. It is the ancient and common purpose. Somewhere around the time of the French Revolution, a second purpose emerged, not to say that it didn't always exist, but it emerged as dominant, and that was to make good citizens. A citizen is not somebody who follows orders. It's somebody who takes an active part in the public marketplace of ideas and deals himself or herself a seat at the policy table, whether the policy table wants him or not. So in order to have an opportunity to try to be a good citizen, you require a package of skills, two of which are quite possible to transmit through formal schooling. Those are to write well and convincingly in an organized fashion and to speak well and convincingly in an organized fashion. Almost immediately from the inception of forced schooling, schools abandoned those purposes entirely, some with no explanation, most with the explanation that there wasn't time to teach what used to be known as the active literacies. The reason writing and speaking are so drastically important to a citizen is that if you can read well and think well, you're still locked up in the prison of your own mind. you have to have rhetorical skill in order to create followers, to make allies. So back to these active literacies, because this idea is just decisively important, and yet I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that it literally doesn't exist in the minds of most people. There maybe is some vague tropism, but the idea of active literacies is the key to not only good citizenship, but to an effective set of powers in the marketplace, just doesn't occur, and schools allow it to die on the vine, so to speak. I mean, it's perfectly possible to acquire these outside of school if you know how important they are, and will substitute television time or baseball time or whatever to get them. But if you rely on a school to make you adequate even at these things, you are in for an unpleasant surprise, because you will arrive at adult life uncomfortable speaking before strangers, unable to sustain an idea. That is, mostly what you'll do is register an opinion, sometimes emphatically. In writing, it's probably worse, because to formally write in such a way that you engage your audience is a tricky thing to do, and it's been studied for thousands of years. It's quite possible to learn and transmit, but someone has to first alert the audience that it's much more important than adding and subtracting, for example. It's the most important thing of all. So you can see how far we've deviated from that deliberately to force schooling, and we'll come to the purpose of that deviation in good time. The first purpose we call the religious purpose, to make good people. Let's call the second purpose the public purpose, to make good citizens. Good citizens argue effectively. They do not follow orders. They do not choose between the candidate they like best and the one they like least. That's not the role of a citizen. All right, the third purpose of schooling comes about with the general expansion of wealth and prosperity and easeful lives in Western society, as our military and trading policies begin to dominate the planet. And that is, this is the thing probably that most parents, if they think about what the purpose of schooling at all is, think of the third purpose, and that's to make each individual his or her personal best, so that whatever their leanings are, that concentration on those and coaching and assistance will give that person their best chance to flourish personally. So we can call that the private purpose. So now we have three traditional purposes of schooling: to make good people, the religious purpose, to make good citizens, the public purpose, and to make people their personal best, the private purpose. Sometime around the middle of the 19th century, a fourth purpose arose, but it was outside the consciousness of ordinary citizens. And that was with the rise of fossil fuels. Remember that prior to the 19th century, for all practical purposes, your sources of energy other than human labor are wind and water and wood, and they're very, very unreliable. You know, they come and they go. And when the wood's gone, it doesn't come back for a long time. So most organized factory work was near some source of water or wind, or it relied on labor. So none of the institutional production mechanisms were very effective. They didn't dominate the life of the community. But with the development of coal and steam power, and then about a half century later, the development of oil, suddenly for the first time in human history, in the 19th century, managers, economic managers, had the ability to predict the future. They could work around the clock. they could make pretty accurate guesses about how many units they could produce in that time. And a need arose to concentrate people in urban centers for that purpose, to make them the assistants of coal and steam and oil. So with that understanding on the part of, let me call them society's managers, not just the rich, but people who devoted their intelligence and their attention to working out arrangements to multiply wealth. And so at that point, human beings ceased to be what they had been for all of human history, and they became pure and simply productive units, or less productive units, or unproductive units. The sentimentality that, in particular, the Christian religions lend to the social order, that your terrestrial achievement is inferior to your salvation, for example, or that you are your brother's keeper. I mean, we could talk about this for a week. But all those things could be set aside, an equation that led to industrial efficiency. Trouble is, we're now between 1830 and, for the most part, after the Civil War, right up through 1880. What we have is intense drawing room conversation about how to make the most of this radical transformation in economic life. Now, the guy in the street having a beer, I mean, he's aware of changes, but he's not aware that these changes are going to have to lead to radical changes in his relationship to